Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland Family Charitable Fund. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life, and by Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. Think about the last time you faced a tough decision, one where either choice was lousy and still you had to pick one. It's the kind of situation where we might say, it feels like I'm stuck between a rock and a hard place. This feeling of torment over a choice is as old as humanity. It is powerfully captured in the Greek epic, The Odyssey, one of our most enduring stories. It's already been a very long journey home from Troy. Odysseus has battled the Cyclops, his men survived being turned into pigs, and now the goddess Circe tells him that he will have to lead his ships through a tight passage between two cliffs.
Once your crew has rowed you past the sirens, a choice of routes is yours. I cannot advise you which to take or lead you through it all. You must decide for yourself, but I can tell you the ways of either course.
Odysseus has to choose between two paths. Go one way and face the six-headed monster, Scylla.
With each of her six heads, she snatches up a man from the dark prow craft and whisks him off.
Six men lost. That's terrible. But on the other side, there is a whirlpool so powerful, it could suck in the whole ship and send the entire crew to the bottom of the sea.
Don't be there when the whirlpool swallows down. Not even Poseidon could save you from disaster.
Two choices: a scary monster, six people die for sure, or deadly whirlpool. Maybe you pass it unscathed, but if it gets you, everybody dies.
All right, this really is the paradigm case of risky decision making.
This is philosophy professor Laura Bushak from the University of California, Berkeley.
Do I go for the known thing or do I go for the unknown thing that might be better but it might be worse? And I think that's the, you know, that's the human condition. So it's unsurprising that we find it as a centerpiece of an ancient myth.
Throughout today's show, we'll be exploring that uncomfortable space between a rock and a hard place. We'll follow people as they weigh different options and try to find the best path. Would you risk offending your god to fix a debilitating health problem?
If for some reason things don't go well and the alternatives don't work, then I won't accept blood.
What if your efforts to save an endangered species could also put them in harm's way?
We might injure or potentially even kill an animal when we're trying to capture it, and that would be a disaster.
And would you trade one harmful substance for another that has unknown side effects?
If I can choose between inhaling four chemicals over the thousands of chemicals in cigarettes, I'll take the four chemicals every day.
But first up, it's one thing to make a tough decision for yourself, but when your decision affects other people, it becomes even harder, especially when the other person is growing inside of your belly. For women living with depression, one of the first big choices in pregnancy is whether or not to continue taking antidepressants. Allie Budner is a reporter in Northern California. She's been examining how women navigate this tricky situation, and she takes it from here.
Corey Ordway lives in a small house with her husband and 15-month-old daughter, Ellie.
Hi, Ellie.
On and off for two decades, Ordway has had the kind of depression that hits hard, and she's just 33.
I get like an upset stomach, I can't eat, I have trouble sleeping, and I often will kind of like get the shakes and shivers when it's really bad.
On the day we met, Ordway laughed easily, even as she remembered her first diagnosis at age 12. The doctor suggested medicine, and Ordway says the antidepressant pills helped her feel like herself again, but she didn't like to talk about it.
I wouldn't let my mom call it medication. I wouldn't let her call it antidepressants. We called it my vitamins.
Embarrassed, she found herself in a push-pull dance throughout her late teens and 20s. Ordway would stop taking the drug and be okay for a while, but sooner or later, she'd hit another wall of depression.
At that point, they said, like, if you've been off and on this many times, you probably should just plan to take it. And I was totally at peace with that.
Until she started trying to have a baby. She wanted to have a drug-free pregnancy, but was on antidepressants when she found out she was pregnant. She couldn't have been happier. but...
Probably in that same second I thought, like, I'm hurting this baby.
She didn't know what to do. There's some medical guidance out there for mothers to be, but no definitive answers. So women have to make a judgment call, along with their doctors. Psychopharmacologist Patrick Finley from the University of California, San Francisco, helps mothers make this kind of decision.
It really doesn't look like there's a substantial risk with the SSRIs.
SSRI means selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor. It's a class of antidepressants used by millions of people, including many pregnant women.
I will say that there are some risks.
Some of the most serious potential side effects are heart problems and lung problems in the newborn. And Finley says SSRI exposure has been linked to babies born a little early, a little underweight, and fussier than average in the first few days. Every medicine comes with some risk, but Finley says the effects of really bad depression can be way worse for both mom and baby than the risks posed by most antidepressants. Pregnant women with severe depression often don't get mental health care, and some use other things to cope.
They're more likely to abuse substances, including smoking, you know, which has a terrible outcome. They're more likely to miss their appointments during their pregnancy. They don't eat as well. They don't exercise as much.
Women with this kind of deep, unrelenting depression are even more likely to have a miscarriage or become suicidal. So Finley often counsels those patients to go on or stay on an antidepressant. That's also the official recommendation from the College of Obstetrics and Gynecology. But if a woman's depression is mild to moderate, Finley says, drugs aren't always necessary. Instead, women can try things like psychotherapy, acupuncture, and diet changes.
Yeah. Let's find some toys.
But Corey Ordway's depression was severe, so she took the medicine.
Anybody who has to care for somebody else needs to be healthy. Yeah, right? It's okay for mommy to take care of herself and take care of you.
At the University of California, Berkeley, philosophy professor Lara Bushak says Corey Ordway's dilemma was classic. The stakes were high, and there was just one chance to make a choice.
This really is the paradigm case of risky decision making.
Bushak teaches rational choice theory.
Do I go for the known thing or do I go for the unknown thing that might be better, but it might be worse? And I think that's the, you know, that's the human condition.
You see examples of this all over healthcare. Taking morphine at the end of life may ease pain, but may also hasten death. A needle stick test to check for birth defects during pregnancy comes with a slight risk of miscarriage. Professor Bushak got interested in the topic because decisions have always been hard for her.
I was always known as the person who would stare at the sock drawer in the morning before being able to pick out a pair.
Bushak says there's lots of ways to work through difficult decisions. Not the sock drawer kind, but the life and death kind. First off, precedent can help us, looking at what we or other people have done in the past and how that worked out. Mom Corey Ordway says when you're having a baby, you can't help but look around and be influenced by friends, family, society in general.
I think I just had this sense that you shouldn't be taking medication when you're pregnant.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
There is a historic incident that cast a shadow of fear over women trying to decide whether or not to take medications during pregnancy.
Concern over the tragic effects of the new sedative thalidomide.
The case of thalidomide. It was a popular morning sickness medication in the early 60s. The pills caused serious birth defects in tens of thousands of babies worldwide and eventually led the U.S. government to toughen regulations around medication for pregnant women. In a broadcast from News of the Day, here's President John F. Kennedy talking about thalidomide in 1962.
Every doctor, every hospital, every nurse have been notified. Every woman in this country, I think, must be aware that it's most important that they check their medicine cabinet and that they do not take this drug, that they turn it in.
So while it might be scientifically outdated now, this catastrophe from the past set a precedent that profoundly impacts the decisions pregnant women make today. Another thing that can shape our decisions is our own mood. How you're feeling, says Professor Bushak, often determines how much risk you're willing to take at any moment.
So, for example, if you're in a good mood, let's say it's sunny outside, then you think it's more likely that good things are going to happen. Maybe you think it's more likely that you know, there'll be an upturn in the stock market or something like that, or that you'll get a promotion. But you're actually less willing to take risks.
Because you're happy enough with the status quo. On the other hand, if you're depressed or in pain, you're more willing to take risks to get out of what seems like your bad situation. And sometimes, says Buschak, those risks can be good ones to take. Her final tip is don't muddy the waters with too much information and well-intentioned advice from other people. Sitting at her kitchen table, Corey Ordway says she was careful who she talked with when she was expecting.
If you want to get down and play, you're welcome to go play.
But she did take her psychiatrist's advice, and she switched to an antidepressant that had fewer believed risks for pregnancy and breastfeeding.
You want another cookie? Here you go. You can have a bite of a cookie.
Ordway and her daughter are both doing great. She says she made the best choice she could, and she's living with it. Still, sometimes she wonders.
Is there anything about who my daughter is now that was affected by that or is affected by that? Like biochemically? Does she have traces of it in her body? But then, like, we all have traces of everything in our body. I feel really like this was the right thing for us, and it would be again.
For The Pulse, I'm Allie Budner.
We're exploring tough choices on The Pulse today where either decision has potential drawbacks. Corey, the new mom we just heard from in Allie Budner's story, was worried about hurting her baby by taking antidepressants. But for many people taking these kinds of medications, psychiatric drugs, the difficult choice is in another area. Feeling better can come with a price. This comes up a lot in the practice of psychiatrist Michael Thays. He has conversations like this with his patients.
So based on your history and also your family history, the mood stabilizer that I think is the best match for you is an old-fashioned one called lithium.
He'll walk them through the good, that the drug will hopefully help them feel better, and the bad.
The side effects of this medicine may show themselves before the therapeutic effects. Some stomach symptoms are probably the most
lithium and other psychotropic drugs often come with very hard-to-manage side effects. Stomach problems, nausea, dizziness, daytime fatigue, and here are the two that people worry about the most, weight gain and a reduced sex drive. Thays explains that part of a psychiatrist's job is to help people balance the benefits and risks.
The number one reason people discontinue medication that is otherwise helpful is tolerability. So if I've not prepared the patient for the possibility of side effects and at least given them a hint that we're going to get on this and take this seriously and manage this carefully, I've not done my job. It is clear that we're talking about an alliance between my patient and me in which we're working together and finding a treatment that is both effective for the condition we're treating and tolerable.
How do you remind them of the good? Sometimes when we have started to feel better, maybe we forget that, oh, actually, I am feeling a lot better than I did 2 weeks ago, but I'm really noticing the side effects now. So how do you remind them of this balance?
Well, one of the ways psychiatrists can take some of the magic out of this is to use rating scales. So, for example, for most of the major conditions we treat, there are simple self-report scales that people can keep track of their symptom burden. And you can fall back and take a look at this. So the same way that you can manage weight gain using a weight chart, you can manage whether the treatment has been a great help, a little help, using a standardized symptom scale, or even a 1 to 10 scale. I started at a 0, and here I am at a 6. And generally, people need to feel at least more than halfway back to where they are to consider staying on a medicine. And ideally, we like people to feel 80, 90, close to 100% back to their best self before we declare victory.
Are medications in your field getting better? Are there new medications that have fewer side effects? Do you see any changes there?
The medicines that came out with the introduction of fluoxetine, which was called Prozac in 1987, and then all the way through the next 15 years, were really designed to be more tolerable and safer than the medicines that preceded them. And similarly, the medicines used to treat schizophrenia and mania, were the newer generation medicines, were designed to have less of the more worrisome neurologic side effects than the first generation did. Unfortunately, weight gain is more of a problem with some of these newer antipsychotic medications than it was with the older generation, but they are safer from a neurologic standpoint. The next generation of medicines is likely to be a lot better for a smaller group of people, and the whole issue of will they be more tolerable or less tolerable may depend on the match with that particular patient. We may not have safer, easier to take medications for a broad number of people in the immediate future, but we may have more effective medicines for specific groups of patients, and that'll save patients from taking these three or four drug cocktails that don't work so well and often have the side effect burden of three or four drugs added together.
Michael Thays is a psychiatrist at the University of Pennsylvania, and let's stick with this topic of medications and side effects for a little bit. Let's say you're sitting down to watch your favorite show, and then a prescription drug ad comes on, featuring happy, handsome people living great lives. They're hopping around in a gym, hugging their grandkids. And then at the very end, the announcer suddenly begins spewing a long list of side effects and drug warnings.
Serious side effects could include increased risk of prostate cancer, worsening prostate symptoms, decreased sperm count, ankle, feet, or body swelling, enlarged or painful...
Wait, what? This is going to give me cankles? Pharmaceutical companies have to mention some of the most dire potential downsides by law, which puts marketers in a tough spot, making a case for a product and then immediately mentioning its drawbacks. Reporter Andrew Stelzer found the people behind the voices that make this not-so-cheery information more pleasant to the ear.
Voiceover artist Debbie Irwin can be whatever you need her to be.
Confident, educational, informative, smooth. You know, because the voice conveys a lot.
Irwin does lots of work for pharmaceutical companies. Because of non-disclosure contracts she signed, Irwin can't read us a commercial she's actually voiced. So she made up the name of a drug and called it ABC.
Like, here. Ask your doctor about FDA-approved ABC, proven to help some people lose weight and keep it off. ABC is for adults who are overweight with weight-related medical conditions or obesity. Excuse me. Its safety and efficacy with other weight loss products or effect on risk of heart problems, stroke, or death is unknown.
The way Irwin's reading this stuff, it doesn't sound so bad, does it? That's no accident.
You know, you want to say these things, but you don't want to be alarmist. Like, you know, easy bruising or, you know, bleeding from a cut or, you know, heavier, oh my God, you know, because that would just raise people's anxiety.
In addition to pleasant-sounding voices, lots of those prescription drug TV ads give us beautiful things to look at that don't seem to match what we're hearing.
You know, you're seeing women doing yoga or dancing or out in fields, and it's very beautiful imagery and everything, while the ear is hearing things that are not so pleasant. So it's kind of a way to counterbalance the scariness of what some of these real side effects are.
This is important information. You have to wonder, are we absorbing it? I asked Ruth Day, who's been studying drug ads for the past two decades.
In order to get the most out of them, you have to be really serious and watch and listen at the same time.
Day leads the medical cognition lab at Duke University. In one experiment, her team showed people two ads for the same health condition with the same number of side effects.
And then later, when we asked people about the side effects, the people had seen the ad where the speaking speed sped up. They remembered less. So there was a decrease in what they could remember.
That might seem obvious, but the speed of these warnings isn't regulated by the Food and Drug Administration. And drug companies only have to tell us the most important risks in TV and radio ads. Kit Akin with the FDA's Office of Prescription Drug Promotion says these commercials should just be a starting point.
This is advertising, and the primary source of healthcare information should really be the healthcare provider.
The FDA has studied when and how people absorb the list of side effects. Akin says best case scenario is showing visuals that reinforce the words we're hearing.
What we found is that presenting the risks in both the audio and the visual parts enhances comprehension. So that's a good thing. It helps people understand. It helps people remember the risks.
But so far, they haven't found any negative effect of seemingly unrelated visuals. When researchers showed positive images during some ads and neutral images during others, there was no difference in what people understood. So those women doing yoga or dancing in the fields might not be distracting us from fatal cases of hives, projectile vomiting, and other highly undesirable consequences. That list of side effects could soon get easier to understand. Aiken says the FDA is studying whether reducing the number and types of risks mentioned will get people to pay more attention. For The Pulse, I'm Andrew Stelzer.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. We're exploring that tight spot where you have to make a choice, but all of your options have drawbacks. That's the case for marine biologists trying to save a small porpoise from extinction. The mammal is called the vaquita. Its home is the Gulf of California, and it's really cute.
The animals are about 4 or 5 feet long. They're gray. They're very shy. They don't like to approach boats or people. They have very dark lips and eyes, so it looks like they're wearing lipstick and eye makeup. They're really pretty little animals.
That's marine biologist Andy Reid from Duke University, and he told me that the vaquita population has all but disappeared as a result of illegal fishing. The vaquitas get trapped in nets.
The only way that we can see forward to prevent the extinction of the species in the near term is to try and catch some of these little porpoises and put them into a temporary sanctuary. The part that is between the rock and the hard place is the fact that nobody has ever tried to catch a vaquita before or hold it in captivity. So everything that we're assuming that we can do or we hope to do is really based on inference with other species of porpoises, and we're hoping that the vaquitas will react in the same way that they do. But it's a risky undertaking. We might injure or potentially even kill an animal when we're trying to capture it, and that would be a disaster because we think that there are less than 60 animals left in the world. So,
did you say 60? Six zero.
So it's one of the most imperiled, one of the most endangered mammals. It's the most endangered marine mammal. Just for contrast, there are more than 1,600 tigers left in the wild, and only 60 of these little animals, fewer than 60. There were 60 in November last year, and we think that some have died since then.
What are the efforts underway to try to save the vaquita? Give us some details.
Right. So the government of Mexico has invested more than $70 million in attempts to try and prevent the extinction of this porpoise, which resides only in Mexican waters. Those include the establishment, initially the establishment of a refuge in which no fishing was allowed, and then a larger ban on the use of gill nets. These are the static kind of walls of net that are used to catch shrimp and fish. So the government of Mexico eliminated the use of gill nets for a period of 2 years in the entire range of the species. In addition to that, there are patrols that are being undertaken by the Mexican Navy and financial assistance programs for fishermen who and their families whose livelihoods have been disrupted by the ban on the use of gill nets.
And I've read that military dolphins might also help in these efforts.
Yeah, that's kind of part of the crazy part of the story. Because these animals are so hard to find, so hard to see, and because there are so few of them now, the Secretary of the Mexican Navy asked the Secretary of the U.S. Navy whether it would be possible to use some of the dolphins that the U.S. Navy uses in its operations to help find the vaquita. And the U.S. Navy has trained several of its dolphins, to find harbor porpoises, which is a similar species, a closely related species, and actually has conducted some field trials to determine that their dolphins will be able to help us find vaquitas to try and capture them and put them into a temporary sanctuary.
And then I guess the goal is to let them be there, breed, and then once the numbers are better, put them back out?
The initial goal is to determine whether or not we can capture the animals. So first of all, we'll see whether we can catch them. And then we'll take a stepwise approach through the other conservation steps. So can we hold them in captivity? Will they thrive? Will they feed and survive in captivity? And then if they do that, can we get them to reproduce in captivity? And then so on. So, but the initial intent is to capture some animals and put them into a safe place so we don't lose all of the animals, so we don't lose the entire species. The longer term goal, if these intermediate goals are met, if we're successful, would be to establish a breeding population, but that's way down the road.
Do you get nervous thinking about these efforts underway and think, ooh, maybe we'll make things worse, or, you know, maybe it won't work out as we had planned?
Well, I think anybody who sits between a rock and a hard place thinks about those things. I do think if we don't try to do something like this, we'll lose the species. So whatever nerves I have are kind of offset by excitement about trying to do something. I think doing nothing will only lead to one outcome. So the fact that we're trying and we have such support from a variety of organizations and individuals makes me feel hopeful that we'll try our best and do our best.
Andy, thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
And good luck.
Thank you very much.
Duke University marine biologist Andy Reid, he says the effort to capture and hopefully save the vaquita will get underway sometime this year. We're talking about being between a rock and a hard place on the show today. And this week, I went on a little field trip in the Pennsylvania wilderness. All right, I think I was probably still within 5 minutes of a strip mall. But I wanted to take a closer look at an issue that presents tough choices for ecologists, removing old dams from waterways. My field trip didn't work out so well. So I'm at Ridley Creek State Park, and it is the worst day. It is just pouring rain, and I'm looking at a dam.
The dam is very popular downstream. People fish downstream of it. It's scenic, but there has been talk about removing it.
This is Rich Horowitz of the Academy of Natural Sciences in Philadelphia. He heads this museum's fisheries section. This dam and thousands like it across the country are relics that once helped power the Industrial Revolution.
First for sawmills, and then for grist mills, and then textile mills, and even when they changed to steam, they were still used as a backup water supply.
These old dams are pretty. The one I was looking at has a still pond-like area, a small waterfall, and then the creek. But dams change the nature of the stream and the ecosystem, and they do cause problems. For example, behind the dam, the water is trapped.
You have a lake, and the lake is not even very deep. It fills up, so it may have a little bit of water right at the foot of the dam, but upstream it'll just be very shallow, silty, muddy water.
That water is often warmer because it doesn't move as quickly. Fish living here can be prone to diseases and parasites. Invasive plants can take hold, and sediment builds up behind the dam.
And if you remove that, then eventually, and eventually is a big word, you will end up with a stream with riffles alternating with pools.
So you restore the stream to a more natural state. That sounds nice, right? But it comes with a slew of potential problems. For example, if you take the dam away, the sediment that's built up over time can travel downstream in large globs. Species that were separated by the dam now mix and mingle. That's not always a good thing. And ecologist Rich Horowitz says when he and his colleagues are dispatched to evaluate dams for removal, it turns into a balancing act of pros and cons.
What I look for first is the historic structure itself. I don't want to remove a dam and then have someone say that was built in 1670 and it was the first example of this kind of dam ever built in the world, and Alexander Hamilton blessed it when it was opened. Well, that wouldn't be 1670, but when it was rebuilt in the 18th century. So you look at historic value, you look at its current purpose. You look at ecologically what's upstream, Are there important species in the impoundment? Are there wetlands above that are formed at the top of the impoundment that support things you want to keep? What are the recreational uses or the visual resources? You look at sediment in terms of quantity, contaminants.
And I guess you have to look, am I exposing wildlife to greater dangers by
yes.
removing this dam?
Yes, right. Yeah, you would look downstream and say, are there endangered species downstream which might be smothered? And you might say, well, eventually the stream will clear up, but that doesn't help it if you've wiped out a population of something.
Does it ever feel like, maybe we should just leave
this? Yeah. Sometimes you feel like, yes, I would like to, but I can't. One example, North Carolina, there was a dam. People talked about removing it. There was an endangered species of fish, a little minnow. Its entire range is pretty much in the headwaters, and an invasive catfish had been introduced. And everyone was worried, saying we better not remove it because this catfish will find its way upstream.
So they did not remove the dam. But guess what? Rich Horowitz told me that the catfish made their way up the stream anyway. Ecologists think fishermen brought them upstream to have more places to fish. So I guess the lesson here is, you're damned if you do. Practicing my mom jokes. So we just heard from Rich Horowitz, who is interested in conservation. And earlier on, we heard from Andy Reid, who is trying to save an endangered species. And right now, a lot of scientists are worried about some of the environmental policies put forth by the Trump administration. Climate change is, of course, a big issue. And there are different groups forming all over the country to organize scientist marches, demonstrations where scientists are going to express their feelings. There is a secret or not so secret Facebook group called March for Science. They already have well over 500,000 members, and they are organizing a demonstration to take place in Washington, D.C. We put a call out to the science community on Facebook and Twitter this week, and we asked, why do you want to participate in this march? And here's some of what we heard back.
My name is Laura Burns, and I'm the Ohio field organizer for Moms Clean Air Force. I have a background in toxicology, and I'm so excited about the Scientists March. Scientists are quite often stereotyped as being shy and reticent, but in this case, we need to buck all stereotypes. We need to buck all of the traditions and show them that we have a voice.
My name is Dr. Nisa Furr. I am a professor at Kaplan University. As a scientist, I am interested in the march because I have dedicated my life to improving the lives of children. I'm really concerned about the environment we are leaving to our children.
Hi, my name is Karina Castillo. I'm in Miami, Florida. My specialty is in meteorology and climate science, and I'm interested in the Scientist March in DC because I believe in the scientific process. I believe in testing hypotheses and either rejecting or accepting them based on the best available data.
The date for the march in Washington has not been set yet. Healthcare is, of course, another major topic right now. In Philadelphia, people with concerns about the future of their health coverage rallied outside the Republican retreat. We'll continue to follow these stories as they unfold in the next few weeks here on The Pulse. Coming up, a woman finds herself at a crossroads. Can she adhere to the rules of her faith and still get a life-changing surgery?
I just went to my car. I cried so hard. And I think either the next day or the day after, I called my orthopedic doctor and told him.
Still to come on The Pulse.
Cancer Treatment Centers of America in Philadelphia supports WHYY.
Physicians and clinicians who diagnose or play a role in supporting patients with cancer are invited to a half-day oncology CME event on Saturday, February 4th. Details at ctcaforum.org. That's ctcaforum.org.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. We're exploring the dilemma of being stuck between a rock and a hard place on the show today. We're talking with people who are weighing their options, trying to come up with the best path. And people working in public health face this challenge on a much larger scale. It's their job to keep entire populations as healthy as possible, reducing risks without unintended consequences. And right now, there's a big debate around smoking and whether or not public health should promote e-cigarettes as a form of harm reduction, Alana Gordon reports.
Brian Collins tried everything.
From, you know, patches to gum to prescription drugs.
But nothing works in helping him kick his habit of 20 years.
I had a very strong addiction to cigarettes.
Collins is 39, and trying to quit over the last 10 years has been tough, especially for a guy who started at the age of 16. Enter the e-cigarette. So where are we headed?
We're going into Sababa Vapes.
Collins and I walk into a place he frequents in Philadelphia for e-cigarette stuff.
Hi, how you doing?
Good, how are you? Inside, it kind of smells like Skittles. A ball pit in the corner gives it a youthful vibe.
I like to come in here and shop for mostly juice, sometimes mods and tanks.
Translation?
Mod is the box that controls...
Collins goes through the basic anatomy of a modern e-cigarette, which is a type of vaporizer. It's an electronic device. The different parts basically turn liquids, or what's called juice, into a vapor that's inhaled through a mouthpiece.
The coil heats up.
A pharmacist in China is credited with inventing the first commercial e-cigarette in 2003. The newer models don't look anything like cigarettes, more like a futuristic inhaler. On the counter are menus of liquids you can order to vape. Max Goldberg is 26 and works behind the counter.
You can find anything from your traditional tobacco flavors, typical menthol flavors, to anything like a peanut butter milkshake, which is one of our top sellers.
As we're talking, Collins takes out his own orange and black device. He inhales.
It kind of replicates the sensation of smoking a cigarette.
Collins has made what I guess you could call a harm reduction plan for himself. He first started vaping with liquid containing 12 milligrams of nicotine in it. He's trying to wean himself off completely. So where are you at right now?
I'm at 3, so I'm making my way there.
He hasn't lit up a real cigarette for more than a year.
I just feel healthier overall.
So could this device be a solid tool in the field of harm reduction? I checked in with Virginia Berridge.
Hi, yes. Can you hear me?
By Skype. She's a historian of public health at the University of London. London's a good launching point. The UK is a pioneer in the entire field of harm reduction, which aims to reduce the risks associated with drug use instead of focusing on stopping it completely. But it's an approach, she says,
which you haven't really got in the States, where there's been a much more prohibitionist attitude, I think, towards substances historically.
But she says tobacco is especially tricky when it comes to harm reduction because of its loaded history. The public health community and the tobacco industry even teamed up in early attempts to reduce the harms of cigarettes, in the form of light cigarettes or filtered ones. But they didn't work, and turns out could be more damaging.
People were feeling that they'd been duped by the tobacco industry, which had collaborated in a program where they knew that things were actually probably almost as harmful as before.
The public health community moved toward a total cessation approach to smoking. So when e-cigarettes gained popularity, it wasn't immediately embraced as a harm reduction tool.
This has become a really polarized sort of area.
Could they really be an effective substitute? And at a more elemental level, are they safe? Jamie Hartman-Boyce is a health researcher at the University of Oxford and recently reviewed the research to date.
They haven't been around that long, so there are definitely particular questions about their long-term safety profile, and we honestly won't know the answer to that until they've been around for longer.
But Hartman-Boyce says, based on the small, solid studies that are out there, e-cigarettes do appear to help people quit. The Royal College of Physicians, the professional body for British doctors, is already advising smokers that e-cigarettes are a helpful way to quit smoking. But here in the U.S., there's more caution.
It's not a simple question of
Are e-cigarettes less harmful than some other tobacco product?
Mitch Zeller is director for the Center for Tobacco Products at the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. He says people need to keep the bigger picture in mind.
The public health impact of e-cigarettes, good, bad, or otherwise, really come down to the answers to two very fundamental questions. Who is using the products and how are they being used?
He worries that e-cigarettes could be a Trojan horse, renormalizing smoking and giving rise to a whole new generation of young smokers. Plus, he doesn't want to make the same mistake we made when we prematurely accepted low-tar and filtered cigarettes as an answer.
The science is evolving, and we need more science. We have questions in need of answering.
In recent months, Zeller's federal agency has come down a lot on vaporizers and e-cigarettes. They're now all considered tobacco products, meaning they'll have to go through a government review. That includes small shops that do things like create their own liquids. And these stricter regulations have vapers like Brian Collins worried.
They're starting to destroy, you know, businesses that people have created to help other people get away from analogs to the digital cigarette.
He believes only the bigger tobacco companies will have the resources to navigate the approval process, crushing these smaller independent guys. Still, he recognizes the science isn't in yet. But in the meantime,
if I can choose between inhaling four chemicals over the thousands of chemicals in cigarettes, I'll take the four chemicals every day.
Which is the very essence of the harm reduction philosophy. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
We've been exploring the space between a rock and a hard place on the show today, and our final story is told by Audrey Butler. She is a Jehovah's Witness, and she lives in Newcastle, Delaware. She shared this story with us for our series, Patient Files. As a Jehovah's Witness, Audrey believes in an interpretation of the Bible that forbids the consumption of blood in any form, including blood transfusions.
Well, the scriptures do tell us that the blood is the soul. So that's how precious blood is to us. It's your life. It's the person's life.
This belief was never tested for Audrey until a major health problem surfaced. She was suffering from intense arthritis in her right knee. It made her leg stiff. She walked with a limp, and it really slowed her down. Still, Audrey wanted to avoid surgery at all costs. She went through injections. She tried to endure the pain and the slower walk. But then, about 6 months ago, she changed her mind while at a mall.
I was shopping. I don't remember the occasion, but I think I was shopping for a gift, and all of a sudden I had to go to the bathroom. The bathroom couldn't have been no more than 50 feet. It took me so long to get to the bathroom. By the time I walked in the bathroom door, I had completely wet myself. I didn't even buy what I was going to purchase. I just went to my car. I cried so hard, and I think either the next day or the day after, I called my orthopedic doctor and told him, I'm ready to have surgery. It was my strong desire to have surgery by a doctor who would perform a bloodless surgery.
My name is Cassandra Upchurch. I am the manager and nurse navigator for the Center for Transfusion-Free Medicine. I am a Jehovah's Witness. I met with Audrey, and that meant educating her as far as what it meant to actually be a bloodless patient. And we went over with her the enrollment forms for the program.
And that's where she explained each element so that I understood what my option was, and I was able to make a choice. Do I want to accept this, or is this something I don't want to do?
As far as Jehovah's Witnesses are concerned, we can't take whole blood, but especially the components of blood we can't take includes white blood cells, red blood cells, platelets, or plasma. So we can't take those. However, there are fractions of those fractions that Jehovah's Witnesses are able to take should their conscience allow them to. It's up to them. But it is not considered a scriptural violation.
I guess the best way I can explain it is if you look at a cake, and you look at the ingredients, the flour, the egg, the oil. When you take out the egg, you're taking a fraction of that product, but you don't have a cake, you have an egg. So The fraction was extracted from blood, but it was not blood. And I felt that it was not the same. It was not something that I could not use to save my life. God put us with the will in mind. We want to live. I don't want to die. So anything that I can do to preserve my life that will still be pleasing to God, I'm going to explore those options. Well, the day of surgery, actually the day before surgery, you know, I talked over with my family. My family knew very well, like, what my beliefs is, but just reminded them that if for some reason, things don't go well and the alternatives don't work, then I won't accept blood. And that may cost me my life, but that's a risk that I want to take. And I need to know that you all will accept my decision and respect my beliefs. The day of surgery was a long day. I did not sleep. You know, you don't know just how vulnerable you are until you're like laying there waiting and waiting. And when I woke up, you know, I just remember just everyone telling me, you did good, you did good. My conscience allowed me to accept this treatment. And I feel confident in my decision that I made the right decision for me.
That's Audrey Butler talking about her recent knee surgery. We also heard from Cassandra Upchurch. She manages the Center for Transfusion-Free Medicine at Pennsylvania Hospital in Philadelphia. Alex Stern produced this piece. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Ilana Gordon, Irina Zhorov, and Elizabeth Fiedler. Alex Stern is our intern. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Paige Flager, our associate producer. Tanya English is our managing editor. And Megan Pinto, the executive producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening. Next time on The Pulse, Emily Brooks knew she wanted to have kids.
Being a parent was very important to me, always. I wanted to be pregnant at least once in my life.
She also knew that she carried a gene for a terrible disease, one that she didn't want to pass on to her kids, so she decided to test her embryos.
9 or 10 were positive for Huntington's. We had 4 that were good.
Don't miss that episode of The Pulse. We're on iTunes, and when you're there, leave us a review. That lets other people find The Pulse, too.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse. Independence is coming to your neighborhood to help you understand healthcare options. Licensed agents can help prepare you for whatever may be ahead. Learn more at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless. Ben Franklin Technology Partners of Southeastern Pennsylvania supports WHYY's The Pulse and are partners with a purpose, providing capital, counsel, and connections to technology entrepreneurs and investors in the greater Philadelphia area. More about Ben at partnerswithapurpose.org.